Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Voices for Justice. I'm your host, Michelle Bart, and tonight we talk about the Boston bombings and other domestic attacks on our own citizens, on our own soil, from our own American-grown kids. We will be taking your calls, so let your voices be heard. Call in and voice your opinions tonight. The call-in number is 917-932-8963. We also have the chat room open. Log on to blogtalkradio.com/NWCave and click tonight's show. We have a few minutes with a couple of our guests, so we want to get right to them. We have Dr. Lonnie Booker, who is an emergency management and terrorism professor at FSCJ. And we also have Dr. Shelley Schaefer, who is our director of our Missing Persons Division at the National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation. Shelley is also an associate dean at FSCJ in Florida, where she teaches criminal justice, emergency management, and fire science. Dr. Schaefer also has 20 years' experience in law enforcement as a criminal crime scene investigator. We welcome both of them to the show. Good evening, Dr. Schaefer and Dr. Booker.
Hi, Michelle.
Good evening.
Thank you so much for being with us on short notice. But I want to get right to it. Dr. Booker, let me ask you, after seeing the organization of so many agencies that came together this past week in order to capture both of the bombers, what is your opinion on how things went with the structure and the way that they went about it?
First of all, thank you for having me on the show this evening. I think this whole organization for the capture of the individual yesterday or the day before was better than what we've handled things in the past. This was how the emergency management and how Homeland Security was supposed to work originally. You had numerous organizations, law enforcement organizations, coming together with one common goal, one common focus, and actually able to come out and accept the rules of engagement and go out and complete a mission and bring the justice to this individual.
So let me ask you, based on what we saw on 24/7 news coverage, it appeared, although that our president was in the know, it seemed as if the operation was being run by the authority of the FBI and local law enforcement rather than the White House. Is that observation correct?
Correct.
So do you think go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Do you think that, you know, obviously we have the best of all forces, you know, fighting the wars in Iran, Iraq, all over the world, where the president is obviously not there on the ground directing everything. To me, it seems as if he knew what was going on, but he entrusted the individuals of Boston and the FBI in Boston and other agencies that were able to pull this off in a way that I don't think any of us have ever seen here in America. Would you both agree to that?
I would agree,
I would
yes.
say Yes, I would say yes. Having been in law enforcement and being on the ground during 9/11, how uncoordinated and how uninformed we actually were during these events. And if you look at that in the past and look at what has happened this week, of course, he was in the know. He was fed accurate information or the best information that he could. And the commanders who were on the ground and the officers who were on the ground were making those decisions and actually had practiced and trained working with multiple agencies during an actual emergency event.
Shelley, do you have anything on that?
Well, I would agree with Dr. Booker. I think that it was handled very well, and people got there quickly. All agencies came together quickly. And I would like to ask Dr. Booker if he thought that fusion centers were involved, and if so, what does that say about our fusion centers? Do you think they were involved with all of this, or...
Yes, especially after we had identified these individuals, a lot of the information we were getting was being ciphered through the fusion centers actually out to the FBI and to the authorities who needed that information.
So that would go to stand to reason that our fusion centers are working in the appropriate fashion, where in the past maybe they were lacking something, but now it seems like everybody's on the same page.
We're getting better at what we're doing. There are still some gaps, as we know that, you know, one individual had left the country and reentered, was never reinterviewed. But there are gaps. However, there are information that's being ciphered through to the proper individuals who need to have it. Yes.
So I guess then my question would be, as a segue to that comment you just made. If the FBI had their radar on this guy in years prior, and, you know, and then we honored, and this is my opinion, we honored their parents with citizenship in our country on September 11th, 2012, which ultimately made the younger boy, Jahara, an American citizen. You know, my concern would be the first thing the parents did was blame the United States agencies for setting up their children. This, to me, seems like it was the whole family may have been planning something all along. That's just my observation and opinion, but what do you make of honoring them with citizenship and knowing that the mother had been arrested for robbing Lord and Taylor at one point, the son was on the FBI radar, and yet here we are, and the latest, the younger boy, is clinging to life.
That's fine. As I said, there are still large gaps that are in our system as far as fact-checking and actually going back and re-interviewing and regathering information. And yes, that was a major malfunction on the part of the intelligence gathering. We never know what individuals or who has the propensity to actually do the things that these individuals have done. Nothing ever popped up on anyone's radar screen, much like the individual from the underwear bomber. The dots were never connected at that point, but I believe now we have done a lot better at connecting more of the dots. The things that his mother or parents have done doesn't specifically say that these guys were actually had the propensity of doing what they've done. Now, with that said, that still doesn't negate the fact that, yeah, there were some balls that were dropped, and there were some leads that were not followed up to actually try to cut this off and actually have further information on what could possibly happen from these individuals and dealing with this family.
What about the fact that the older son had been over there for 6 months, and wasn't it the Russian government that actually contacted our agencies to give them a heads up that something was not right with him?
That's news to me. I haven't gotten or seen or read anything about that information, but that's new information for me.
Okay, so for both of you, you know, when CNN released the Twitter account that they found on the younger boy, that's, I call him number two, the white hat boy, I can't pronounce his name, Jahara, that boy had posted a lot of things from before the first bomb at the Boston Marathon to the day after, to the day of after the bomb took place, such as things, ain't no love in the heart of the city, stay safe, people. One that stood out to me, there are many people that know the truth but stay silent, and there are people that speak the truth, but we don't hear them because they're the minority. One could read into all of these, but then when the Twitter started going even further, saying, I'm a stress-free kind of guy, or you need to get Claritin clear, to me, reading into that, stating, you know, the bomb's gone off, it's smoky, get Claritin clear, that was posted after the bomb took place in the Boston Marathon. What do you make of tweets like this of a guy that the people he was following were Google Earth, Google Maps, and then many Russian connections? What would one read into that when you're looking at terrorism?
I could see a couple of things. I could see possibly sending out some type of code saying the job's done, then something else can occur, or notifying other individuals who possibly, and I'm not saying that this was an actual sale, but if it was or if it were, it could be communication for others. Okay, my part's done. Now it can, your part can begin, and we need safe passage to leave the country or leave the area, if you will. You could read a number of things into that. So that, to me, really, that's the part that stands out. Secondly, from my hostage negotiation training, it also tells me that he's finished, he's done, he knows he's about to meet his possible demise, and he's just saying his conscience is clear and he's ready to end it all.
Any input on that, Shelley?
Well, what I did want to ask Dr. Booker is, although they were from a part of Russia, my understanding is a part where there are a lot of Muslim or Islamic people, but they were United States citizens. Would we classify this as domestic terrorism or international terrorism? Or would we not know that yet?
Right now, since they do have a Chechnya or international tie, he has been seen with YouTube videos forming or discussing jihad. One could draw that conclusion. I would not say that this is domestic at this point. At the beginnings, I said it was domestic due to the fact of there was such of a small fatality rate. If you look at the main purpose of terrorism is to create as much havoc and mayhem and instill fear in the populace, and they really have done that. And from a domestic terrorist perspective, they're basically going for some type of political cause, or there is a cause that they're the only ones who believe in. Right now, we do not know or have an understanding of why these individuals did what they did. So that remains to be seen right now.
Is it strange that they would pick, I mean, to me, it's strange that they would pick the Boston Marathon. I mean, you know, we all know what happened on 9/11 and they picked major places if the planes actually made it there. But the Boston Marathon, those are just innocent people running. Why, or if you can think or get into their minds at all, why would they have picked a place like that? I mean, no place is a good place, but why would it not have been a federal building or something like that? They picked a marathon race.
That's what I was thinking, too.
Could you get into the mind of them at all, or would you know the answer to that, or surmise anything?
My thinking of it is that, like I said, they're looking for a target-rich environment and a way that will be publicized and enough people will know and be enough individuals around to create as much havoc and much mayhem as possible. And with the Boston Marathon, they know one thing, it's televised. People will be there with cameras and news agencies will be there filming certain parts of it, and automatically you will know that if something was to happen within minutes, it will be worldwide, globally. To me, that was their main focus, is to try to get the populace, not only just Boston, but the United States and the world to know that, hey, we've done this, and to sit back and watch their craft, if you will, and going out and creating this havoc that they've done.
Yeah, his tweet on the 15th had been, "God hates dead people or victims of tragedies, LOL. Those people are cooked." So obviously, you know, I have an issue with everyone thinking that he's been brainwashed by his older brother and that his brother was the leader of the pack here. I'm not ready to throw that into the ring and say this boy was, you know, lured into this. I think he has his own mindset. No one made him tweet the things he tweeted. And that says a lot to me as someone that looks at media for a lot of conclusions, that this individual had something else in his head. My concern is, and either of you could weigh in on this, that the fact that it didn't appear, as Shelley stated, why the Boston Marathon? Yes, the media is there, but why not leave? It almost appeared as if they had not finished what they've come for, and my concern was MIT. You know, were they trying to do something with technology, technical or technology terrorism, or something that the bigger thing did not come because they screwed up? Even though they killed four innocent lives and hundreds are, you know, they have a whole road, a hill to climb in their life with what's happened and everything else, I just don't feel like this is over. Do either of you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I from my perspective, I think there are some other individuals who are party to this actual offense. Mm-hmm. It's kind of ironic that this individual had been lying in wait in this boat for how many hours the other day, and what, 15, 20 minutes after the governor actually said, okay, you can go about your normal routine, thank you for cooperating, and so forth, and all of a sudden he's crawling out of his boat and this intense gun battle ensues. We still don't know whether or not if he had a cell phone or any of that stuff. My conclusion is that he did, and someone called and said, okay, the coast is clear, leave where you are, we'll pick you up at X place. And he just got caught coming out of that boat and was severely injured with the flashbangs and the gunfight. He just said, I'm done. I can't fight any longer.
Right. And there was one, and I'm not sure if it was the older or the younger, that went back to the dormitory at school and actually went to the gym. They have his card swiped. You need to swipe a card to get into the dorm, and you need to swipe a card to go to the gym. And there was people that knew him. I don't know if they were actually his friends, but people that knew him that actually had conversation with him after this incident. Mm-hmm. So I think he was just going about his life, or like we said, maybe he was notifying the others that my job's done, now you guys step in. So
correct.
we could see more things happening. I mean, it's never, we're never really safe, and I think with all that's gone on, we can maybe see that some more things are getting ready to come down the pipeline.
Definitely.
So,
I concur.
Dr. Booker, let me ask you, you know, we're seeing, I too believe that this is international driven, because let's face it, the older son was driving around in a Mercedes. He has a family. He spent 6 months, I don't know about any of you, but to spend 6 months in another country and not work takes a lot. So, you know, obviously whatever their mission is, they needed it funded. Will that come out soon, that where the funding for all of this came to play?
The funding, is that's the hard part, because the money can change numerous hands and go through numerous filters to actually filter that money to the actual individuals who are going to carry out whatever terrorist act. That's the hard part. Collecting the intel and trying to connect the dots of individuals, it's even harder than that, because you never know from one cell to the other, will not know who is a part of it and what their role or responsibility is for whatever X mission. So as far as the funding is concerned, we may never know how deep that well runs, unless someone actually just comes out and says, hey, here's something from Chechnya or wherever, Yemen or whatever other country that was filtering the money to them. So we may never know that information.
Do you think that they chose that week of all of their activity in Boston for some symbolic purpose to the Oklahoma City anniversary date of the 19th?
I had originally thought that. But once all of the other intel was coming out about these two individuals, I kind of changed my thought process about that.
Okay.
Given their nationality, given the possibilities, and given their backgrounds and the things that they have actually developed and found about these individuals, I do not think that they're related to Oklahoma or to Waco, but I think these guys do have a international terrorist background or some type of undertone that's actually in this. And then this is a side thought that I just thought of. This may be a test to see what we're capable of and
mm-hmm.
how we can respond or how fast we respond to an actual event.
What I found kind of interesting, or it may actually be disturbing depending on how you look at it, is the family of these two young men were televised pleading for them to give up, and what they did was wrong. And I found that interesting. For one, the family was kind of, hey, you guys did wrong and you guys have to give it up. But it could also have been deception, as everybody knew, or everybody in that area or whoever knew that they were going to do this. So I don't know. At first I thought it was, wow, the family, you know, was telling them to give up. This is a good thing. But now that I'm thinking about everything that we're discussing, that just could have been a ploy.
Exactly.
True.
I agree.
Yeah.
So. Before we let you go on to dinner and all, Dr. Booker, anyone that might have a question for either Dr. Schaefer or Dr. Booker, you can call in to 917-932-8962. We're reviewing the Boston bombings, and then we will move on in a short time into a couple others. But we're going to do a whole show in the near future on the impact and reaction of media. We have a media council, and we're putting together a show for that. But I want to touch on that just a tad bit because, you know, as a member of the Society of Professional Journalists and such, I was very happy to see that they were tweeting reminder messages to reporters. Because it is sad to see that in today's society where the media and reporters have a responsibility to keep people informed, that they're all trying to beat each other to who's going to announce it first. But with that said and put aside, the fact that the media was 24/7, all of our eyes were glued. Many of us were freelancing or working with networks and such to make sure that the public was informed. But in the end, don't you think that that accountability to the FBI and everybody of authority that use the media to get their messages out there actually basically showed the sign of the future of how we're going to capture these criminals?
Yes,
one of you?
Very much so. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. I do believe that, but I also believe giving too much information in an ongoing event like this, bad guys watch TV as well, and
right.
they can be fed all of the information as well, and know exactly where the police are going to go or where they're at and kind of could set up how to avoid or set up some type of counter move. So it's a dual sword, but it's also good and advantageous for all the populace to be informed to know, hey, avoid this area, don't go here, don't do this, and so forth. But it's also a bad thing that the criminals actually are watching the same programs and get their information on what's going on as well.
And I have the similar belief that media can be good and it can be bad. And, you know, the good is that we're making the public aware, and like Dr. Booker said, lock down in your houses, don't go out, all that type of stuff. And it can also be bad as when we post a picture, like they posted the picture of the one in the white hat and the one in the black hat, they could be watching this and they could be planning an escape, in which they didn't, but we could never find them. So I think media has pros and cons to it, very similar to what Dr. Booker was just explaining.
I agree. I also think that by stating these are the individuals we're looking for, it had everybody looking for them. But what if somebody, because the guy that was naked that they unclothed looked like the older boy, and then there's a missing teenager from Brown University that some media outlets were saying was the boy in the white hat, number two, the younger son. And so then you get that family's hopes up that, oh, my son's not missing, but he's doing this. And then it comes to find out that the boy from Brown University had nothing to do with this. He's still missing. And now you've disrupt that. But it was just like you never knew what was accurate and what wasn't accurate. For the most part, CNN is a very reputable news source. We partner with CNN and especially HLN very much on many things that we do, and we kept that station on most of the time. But you know, when you hear our sources are telling us. Well, if your sources are telling you one thing and it's not really true that they have them, I would start questioning the sources, you know. But that's going to be a whole nother show. But from my standpoint, I think the way they did everything this past week, this is the quickest they've ever, let's call them a terrorist, you know, quickest that they ever captured anybody, in my opinion. But I do listen to a lot of people that post things, and some of the attorneys that we know had been posting, was it really a necessity to close down the entire Boston area and all of its transit and the $33 million it cost them to shut down the city? What do you say about that, Dr. Booker?
Is $33 million worth the lives of the millions of people in the city of Boston and the surrounding area? I believe that it was a smart move to do that. This is the first time I've ever known a actual city to be locked down where individuals are not actually out moving about. It was very interesting, and the fact that this was accomplished in such a short amount of time and the vast cooperation from the citizens in, of that city, and especially of Watertown, they all abided by those guidelines and, you know, and helped law enforcement do their job and to find these individuals.
I thought it was very well done myself.
I would have to agree. I think, you know, that is a lot of money, but there, it was necessary, and it is the first time that I've seen the cooperation all around that the city was on a lockdown. And, you know, unfortunately it cost some money, but who knows how many lives we've saved, and we can't put a price tag on a life. So,
exactly. And one last question before you go, Doctor. I know that today it came out that they're looking to possibly charge the suspect. He is not coherent. He cannot speak. I mean, you know, but like one of the reporters said, you know, you can charge people that are deaf. So what's the difference? Where do you think it's going to go from here? Do you think he'll be, charged with terrorism, or is it going to be something that we saw in, like, Timothy McVeigh, where he's brought to justice and then take a life for a life, and execute the man?
I believe right now, just on the surface, I think they're going to keep him as an enemy combatant, because if they charge him officially through the federal government, then that opens up a lot of other things. And I'm not an attorney, so I can't speak eloquently from that perspective. But I think if they keep and charge him as an enemy combatant and go through the proper process that way, this is a complete different situation from what Timothy McVeigh had actually done. He's more of, I put him in the line more of a domestic terrorist versus international. So if they deem him as an international terrorist, I think that's the route that they would go.
Even though that he's an American citizen now?
Even though, yes, ma'am.
Well, we saw in the 9/11 that a couple of the pilots or terrorists that flew the planes into buildings actually had been amongst Americans for years leading up, and actually got their pilot's license down in Fort Lauderdale.
Yes.
We just don't know our neighbor today, do we?
No, we don't. I believe one of the individuals, the hijacker, he had actually married and was living and going back and forth to Germany visiting his wife. And so, I mean, that's how normalcy that or normal these individuals try to appear to society. Several of them had been pulled over the night before or days before for minor traffic violations, and nothing was ever done. They was given a citation and left on their way. A lot of this stuff is, I think now once individuals pop up on our radar, I think we are more, I guess, a little bit more quick to start trying to ascertain more information on them and try to have more information and survey those individuals so that we can kind of keep track of them and find and make sure that this 9/11 doesn't happen again.
And Dr. Booker, if I'm not mistaken, don't you also teach TSA officers on the importance of emergency management and safety in the airports and terrorist activities and such?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
So I think kudos to you for helping out in that aspect as well as all the rest of the things that you do.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, we sure do appreciate you taking the time, Dr. Booker, and hope that we can have you back sometime in the future because I could talk to you all day.
Well, anytime you just let me know, I'm at your disposal.
Well, thank you so much. You have a nice dinner.
Thank you, Dr. Booker.
You too. Thank you. Thank you.
Michelle?
Yes.
There was something that I wanted to touch on that that kind of was it was mentioned, and I wanted to provide a little bit more information for the listeners.
Sure.
Is that to me, it was amazing how the community and law enforcement came together because there was many innocent people that did not get injured that stuck their neck out to help those that were.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the early 90s, there was an initiative called COPS, Community-Oriented Policing. And we've had our problems with that, but it shows, I believe it was the Lord & Taylor outdoor cameras that actually got the videos of these two men and went to police, or the police went to them, and shared the information. We also had citizens saying what they saw. And I think that when we all gather, law enforcement, community, everything gathers together and shows that unity and the community spirit, I think that the country can do wonders to battle certain things such as what did occur. I mean, it's unfortunate that so many people got injured and that four lives had to be taken. But as we were talking, it's just amazing that everything came so quickly and the people were caught. We don't know who else is involved, as Dr. Booker stated, but community-oriented policing does have has its way in our lives today, and the community can come together and do so much, and I think that's very important. We lose track of that sometimes, and as an example would be people are comparing the Trayvon Martin case and the George Zimmerman to community-oriented policing. That was not community-oriented policing. Zimmerman was a neighborhood watch person, and we have yet to
There's
see.
There's a difference, yeah.
Yes, and we have yet to see what will happen with that case. That's also an unfortunate case. But we don't know all the details of that case. But the community, just how they have come together and how Dr. Booker was saying he's never seen a city go on lockdown and pay attention to what law enforcement was saying, just shows a lot. And the community saying they saw this guy or they saw this guy or whatever the case, they often say it takes a village to raise a child. Well, it takes an entire community plus law enforcement agencies, federal and local and state, to take care of a country and take care of catastrophes that may happen. And I just wanted to mention that. I've never seen such camaraderie from communities and everybody involved.
I would agree with that. I mean, it was just amazing just seeing how many people were working together from the community and how many people actually ran to the disaster than what most of us would run away from it. They were running to help folks. And, it definitely was a nail-biting week, to say the least. But the last 24 hours in the capture of the two men definitely was captured for the world to see. And I want to remind our callers that we are talking about the Boston bombers, as well as other domestic attacks on our own citizens, on our own soil, from our own American-grown children. So if you have a question for Shelley or myself, please dial 917-932-8962. The chat room is also open. And right now I want to take a few minutes and play something that Aaron Burnett over at HLN put together, a recap of the last 24 hours. And so let's take a listen to this.
Today, we are enlisting the public's help to identify the two suspects.
Shortly after 5 p.m. yesterday, FBI Special Agent in Charge Richard DeLaurier releases these images of the two men they believe are suspects behind the Boston Marathon bombings.
We have two new pictures that we want to show you.
Just hours later, a second photo is circulated online of suspect number two walking away from the bombing. A little after 10 p.m., two men are spotted at a convenience store in Cambridge near the campus of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
We must have heard about 60 gunshots.
Chief DeVoe is advising all Watertown East End residents to remain in their home.
As we are on the air at 11 p.m., we learn a 26-year-old police officer from MIT has been shot and killed. Moments later, Boston police begin a high-speed chase for two males after receiving reports of an armed carjacking. According to authorities, the carjacking suspects begin throwing explosives from the car as police chase them from Cambridge to Watertown.
There were dozens of police officers with their guns drawn. We could hear them yelling.
At approximately 1:23 a.m., residents in Watertown are jolted awake as dozens of police exchange gunfire with the two suspects.
And then, like, boom, boom, like three big bangs.
A fierce firefight with explosions follows, leading to the death of one of the men, later identified as suspect number one. Suspect number two escapes on foot. By 3:45 in the morning, Massachusetts State Police warn Watertown residents to stay in their homes, lock their doors, as police begin searching door to door. A little after 5 a.m., as day breaks, the city of Boston begins moving into a lockdown, suspending mass transit and asking businesses to remain closed.
It is important that folks remain indoors, keep the doors locked, and not open the door.
At 8:14 a.m., authorities identify the suspects as brothers, 26-year-old Tamerlan Tsarnaev and 19-year-old Jahar Tsarnaev. At 11:55 a.m., the city of Boston is at a standstill as relatives of the two suspected bombers begin to speak out.
Turn yourself in and ask for forgiveness.
At 1:26, Boston police tweet that 60% of the search is done. At 3:42, investigators find significant amounts of homemade explosives in Watertown.
We are asking the public to remain vigilant.
6 p.m., the lockdown for the Boston area is lifted, meaning people can again leave their homes, even though a suspect remains at large.
Was that guns?
But less than an hour after the lockdown is lifted, shots are fired in Watertown. Police scramble to the scene.
I just heard what sounded like multiple assault rifle shots to me.
8:15 p.m., a person believed to be Jahar Tsarnaev is cornered on a boat in a yard in Watertown. Hundreds of law enforcement surround the suspected bomber. And at 8:45, police in Watertown, Massachusetts, break out in cheers, followed by crowds coming to the streets to celebrate.
Once again, you're listening to Voices for Justice, a show put on by the National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation. We have Dr. Shelley Schaefer with us this evening. If you have any questions, please call 917-932-8962. We are talking about the Boston bombings this past week. We're also looking at domestic attacks on our own citizens, from our own, on our own soil, from our own American-grown kids. And Dr. Schaefer, I want to take it back to you and ask you, you know, what's going on here in America? You know, we're so worried about terrorism, international terrorism, but yet we have individuals from our own people here in America, and they seem like they're getting younger. Is that just me, or
with the amount of school shootings that have been taking place, for what usually the suspects, which are young, such as Sandy Hook. I mean, Columbine happened several years back, but those are high school students. Since they're killing themselves, we don't know the rhyme or reason. The parents apparently didn't know things were wrong, but there were some clues that were chosen by the parents as just, oh, that's just regular teenage activities. Those are more, I think, your domestic tragedies and travesties that are happening. And, you know, this one was a big one. And I think it's more international, as we spoke about before, but it's just one thing after another. What's happening here, I'm not sure. America is a target for many countries. I mean, we have North Korea threatening to send missiles our way, which we're well prepared for. As soon as a missile comes up, the missile will be shot down in the water by our military. We're very well prepared. But for something like this, when there were no clues, and, you know, the fusion centers, I believe they acted as quickly as possible. And like we mentioned before, this is the quickest we could see people that were captured or killed.
Do you think they wanted to get caught?
You know, it almost seems like it because they didn't leave the area. I mean, I'm not a killer, a murderer, or a terrorist, but I think if I would have done any of those acts, I would have left the area as soon as possible. So in some of the Muslim religions, for a male to die, they have these promises in heaven. And so they're not really concerned if they live or die, which is the case with the planes that went into the World Trade Center on 9/11. Those people that were on those planes are promised things in heaven due to their religion. So they don't really care if they live or die. I don't know if that's the case with our Boston bombers. There's still so much to be found out. And when this young man comes to, maybe we will find out more information, or maybe we won't. And maybe we should be preparing again quickly for another episode to occur in the United States. It still baffles me why it was the Boston Marathon. It seems if someone had a problem with our country, not that it's right and not that I condone it, but it seems they would go after something federal. Not a Boston Marathon.
Or within a building. I mean,
correct.
If they would have put those bombs inside a building, they would have done a lot more damage than what they did on the outside.
Correct. And they did a lot of damage. The 160, I think the number's up to, I'm not sure, it may have risen. Those people are critically injured. I heard within the first hour of the bombing, the people that were taken to the hospital, there was at least 10 amputees done within the first hour. And as a matter of fact, there was a young girl, I'm not sure of her age, maybe 9, 10, that was running for Sandy Hook. And she was injured in the bombing, and both of her legs were amputated. And when you think of all these innocent people, I mean, even people that are working for the federal government, you know, not the president, but just people at the World Trade Center or people in another federal building, they're all just innocent people just trying to make a living. And here we have people coming in, whether they're domestic like Timothy McVeigh or international, we have people coming in and killing our citizens. And, you know, the school shootings, they're trying to pass the bill on gun control. These young men had guns. You know, the adage of, well, guns don't kill people, people do. Well, a gun doesn't fire by itself. And,
right.
You know, I know that's a constitutional, the Second Amendment to the Constitution says the right to bear arms. However, the Constitution was written hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago.
When life was different.
when they had one shooters, you know, there was one shooters. Now we have automatics, AK-47s, semi-automatics. We have all kinds of weapons out there, and I don't know how they would, you know, there needs to be something done different. Kids that are getting a hold of guns and shooting up schools, and people that are making their own bombs and destroying innocent people in federal buildings and buildings in which we do our business out of in America is just a travesty. And it seems like the world outside of America is pretty much against us. And who knows the answer to why?
For those calling in, I have about five callers, and it's not queued to speak to the host, so if you're just sitting there listening, that's okay. And if you want to ask a question of either one of us on the call today, please dial 917-932-8962 and press 1 to queue to speak with the host. Before we move on from this travesty and talk a little bit about some of the bombings in the past, I want to play a clip from Raising America, where Dr. Drew talks about how to speak to your children about what happened this week. So from HLN and Raising America, here's Dr. Drew.
Well, images we will never forget. The chaos after the Boston Marathon bombing, the injured, the heroes, the fear. You know, now there's those explosions in Texas, the fires, homes leveled, the injured being carried to safety, rescue workers still looking for people. You know, Dr. Drew, we talked about the effects of seeing all these images over and over again. You know, when does the stress and the fear actually turn into PTSD, where we've really got to intervene, you know, in particular with our kids?
All right, well, this is, you know, we are a parenting show here, and I've got a lot to say, so cut me off if I get too long-winded about this.
It's not easy to do that, Dr. Drew.
You know, it's easy. Trust me, it is. But let me start with what you guys were saying before the break, which was let's avoid what's going on out there and protect our kids from it. Yes, that's a good idea, but no, that's impossible. I'm sorry, but your kids are absorbing this all over the place. They may not even be thinking about it consciously, but they are seeing this material, and it isn't particularly after the age of 8. I guarantee you, even if they say, no, we're not talking about it, they are thinking about it, they've been exposed to it, and it is incumbent on parents to not pour on them our feelings and thoughts about it, but to make kids feel safe, to help them contextualize this. They imagine in their mind, because kids are naturally grandiose, that they're next, that the bomb's going to go off in their backyard next. So it is our job as parents, A, to say you're safe, B, this is rare, and C, this is not going to happen to you. Contextualize it. That's 3,000 miles away, perhaps, whatever. It's a circumstance that does happen in our world, and to digest the reality of the world they live in, but don't allow them to become anxious about their grandiosity, which is normal, that it's going to happen necessarily to them.
But
that
Dr.
is number
Drew,
one.
With all due respect, Dr. Drew, I think it is so hard to do that, because I remember when
I was
in junior high school, and I witnessed the space shuttle, okay, when that exploded.
Right. Yeah.
It did not have the impact on me where it was like I saw it, I was scared of it, and then I just sort of moved on. So how much information is too much information for these kids? Okay, I understand that they have to know something. They're going to be inundated with this material, but shouldn't we leave it up to the parents as far as deciding to talk to them when they start to ask questions and start saying a terrible thing happened?
Absolutely. And you guys did exactly the right thing, was ask your kids open-ended questions about, does it bother you? Is this a problem? Are you talking about it? Do you have any questions? I'm here for you. But follow it with a simple statement. This ain't going to happen. You're safe. You're fine. These are rare events. Just keep reassuring them about their safety. How old were you, Mara, when you saw that? 12, 14, something like that?
Yeah, I was in 7th grade.
Okay.
And I still remember.
Let me just tell you. But that's right, because it was traumatizing to you, and 12-year-olds process this material by shutting it out and going, all right, let's go to lunch. The fact is, though, they absorb it, but because of the stage of development they're in, which is what we have to remember as parents, they don't deal with it the way adults deal with it. They don't deal with the way children deal with it. They shut it down, and they detach from it because that's the stage of development they're in. again, as a parent, you don't necessarily resurrect that. You just go, I understand. You saw that. It's got to be troubling. I'm here if you want to talk about it. Try to connect your feelings. And again, if you were my child, I would particularly have that conversation with the young girl, 12-year-old, at 10 o'clock and 9 o'clock at night because of their cortisol cycling. That's when they start to open up and connect to feelings, not so much during the day. And yet here you are still thinking about that event that happened 30 years
my
ago.
My parents never talked to me about it, though.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That's
we
what
never
I'm saying.
Had those conversations.
You're still thinking about
well,
it.
And I still think of images.
Shelley, let me ask you, you teach college students. How do you all discuss what transpired this week to your students in your class?
Well, the discussion goes on as to why it happened, to the ramifications that it may cause America. We want to know who these people are, where they came from, and you know, what does it mean for us in the future? Can we expect another bombing in a month, 2 months, 6 months, a few years? We don't know what we can expect. So it's that's what we discuss. Our students are able to just say what they believe has happened and what's going on and things like that, and what will happen in the future. Our future is, you know, we don't know if it's dismal. We do know that we have a strong military and we are able to handle things like this. And the conversation just continues as to where it's going, what needs to be done. We have them write proposals and papers on things that can be done to stop such terrorism. I did want to mention there was someone in the chat room that said in the Quran there's nothing that says if the people die they get benefits, which were the 72 virgins. I didn't know the number. And if that is not in the Quran, then I apologize. I have not read the Quran. But that was what was said is why they're not afraid to die. Maybe they're promised some other things when they go to heaven. I'm not familiar with the Quran at all. That was just what we have had knowledge of in our disciplines.
Well, thank you for talking about that. I was kind of wondering what they were implying there. Again, if you have a question, please feel free and dial 917-932-8962 and let your voices be heard. Before we move on, Attorney General Martha Coakley from Massachusetts was on the air today stating that there has been a fund established. It's called One Fund. As we've seen in many, many disasters in past years, whether local or internationally, people start bogus sites, bogus organizations, things of that nature. Of all the organizations, if you choose to make a donation, send it to one place that's legit. And when the Attorney General tells you about a site, one could only assume it's legit. So one, O-N-E, fund, F-U-N-D, boston.org. OneFundBoston.org is the site that the Attorney General in Massachusetts is telling folks to donate to if you'd like. We've had so many people this past week, like you said, come together for the common goal of bringing down a terrorist slash citizen slash neighbor that tried to destroy, you know, not only their city, their people, and the spirit of Boston, but we see that can't happen and it won't happen. Boston came together and definitely made the world know you can't mess with the folks in Massachusetts. So we remember the victims, and we will close the show tonight in a little while remembering all the victims of bombings, but we can't forget all the other bombings that came before. And we know of one that actually had an anniversary on Friday, the Oklahoma City bombing on April 19th, 1995, of the Alfred P. Murrah building. It was a federal building, and the individual that was convicted and executed by lethal injection was Timothy McVeigh. And I want to play just a snippet from Channel 5, who did an interview of Dan Herbeck, the author of American Terrorist. And let's take a listen to what it's like to hear from a terrorist and hear something from the dead on this interview with Tim.
Chilling words from Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh. You're about to hear them for the first time.
The confession was recorded by reporter Dan Herbeck, who wrote a book about it. I talked to him today about those tapes, and it's new tonight. Days away from the 15th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing, and tonight we are hearing from Timothy McVeigh himself.
And it was at that point when I was fully intent in my life that I was going to live outside the law.
That's McVeigh talking about his life. Dan Herbeck co-authored a book after making these tapes with McVeigh.
In fact, he did make some many bizarre statements, but he was also very articulate, very, very intelligent, and surprisingly likable for someone who did such a horrible thing.
Herbeck says McVeigh's hatred of the government may have had early roots.
When he was a little kid, like many little kids, he was picked on by bullies. And he started to look at the U.S. government as the biggest bully in the world.
He says McVeigh felt that way about Waco.
It burned into my memory. I'm emotional right now as I talk about it. You know, I felt absolute rage. With Oklahoma City being a counterattack, I was only fighting by the rules of engagement that were introduced by the aggressor. Waco started this war. Hopefully Oklahoma would end it.
Herbeck says he picked Oklahoma City for a reason.
The Murrah building was a very stately-looking building, and that it was out there in the open. It could easily be seen, and he felt that it would make a very striking visual. So it's sad to say that even terrorists think about photo possibilities.
Chilling words from Oklahoma City bomber.
Dr. Schaefer, in regards to the Oklahoma City bombing, the author, Dan Herbeck, stated right there at the tail end of his interview that even folks like Timothy McVeigh, like the limelight. Isn't that what Dr. Booker was telling us in the beginning? Maybe they picked the Boston Marathon in order to have all the media attention that they could get?
Yes. Sorry, my dog's barking. Yes, that's quite possible that they do like the limelight, but I don't know why they would want to get caught. That's what I'm confused about. The limelight's great, but then why do you want to get caught doing that type of thing? I don't understand that type of limelight. I understand a limelight as I'm doing something good, I'm making a difference in the world or in the country or for people. That to me is a limelight that people should strive for, an ambition that people strive for, instead of making chaos and injuring people and making a statement without even making a statement. I mean, what was Timothy McVeigh's statement? I don't like the U.S. government, so I'm going to kill all these innocent people and children. That to me is not a statement. That to me is just, you don't agree with what the government's doing, you have the freedom to move somewhere else. So I don't really understand why anybody would want to be in that type of a limelight. But it could be true. And
I'm seeing in the chat room in regards to, organized religion and, it's almost, you know, cult-like, where you see a lot of these individuals, you know, see something in their religion that really doesn't exist, but they make it up themselves, or they're following somebody like we saw in Waco, Texas, you know, following somebody that they believe, you know, rules the world, and eventually hurting so many others in their crossfires. Is this something that goes deep on prevention and such, where religion is concerned, or you know, this week, I mean, we had the gun violence vote this week in Washington as well. Is that what these two were complaining about? I mean, it's so hard. And I wish we had a psychiatrist, but in the future we'll have Dr. Dale Archer back with us to kind of pick their brain and tell us what their brains are like.
And at times, there are religions or people that follow other people, and the leader makes money. And as an example, I live in Florida, and in Lake City, Florida, which I do not live near, there's a church that had started. It's called the Mead Church, and it was started by a man named Mead. And he started the church, and he told people that if they joined his church, they were going to live forever, and they weren't going to die when the world was going to come to an end on, what was that, December 21st, 2012, and they wouldn't die when that took place. He got a great deal of followers, and people moved from all around the country to be in Lake City, Florida, with this church. He now owns a very huge church and a great deal of land where all of his followers live on. Does he make a fortune? I don't really know how much he makes, but for these people to follow what he says, you know, people in the country are just reaching and grasping for straws on who to follow and what to follow instead of following what's in their heart. And I don't necessarily know if they're doing it out of religious perspectives or if they're doing it out of fear or if they're just being brainwashed. It's a very difficult situation to look at, and without offending anyone, I'd reserve my opinions as to how that occurs because it's not my intention to offend. But we have to dig deep into our hearts, and I think that whatever religion you are, you know, digging deep into your heart is what's important, and hopefully your heart has good intentions, because I don't know that people are born evil. I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't know that people are born evil or they are trained to be evil or something happens in their psyche that makes them do some kind of tragic things that have been done in this country and even around the world.
Yeah, that's definitely, you know, I can see like Dr. Archer, you know, talking to us about the brains of these individuals, as well as then bringing in our media council to discuss, does the impact of media kind of reflect of who these people become, such as in gaming and things of that nature, as we saw like with John Holmes in Aurora, Colorado. I mean, Dr. Drew spoke with Dr. Lynn Fenton, his psychiatrist, and his psychiatrist, because of HIPAA laws, could not tell anybody her concerns and then ultimately look at the outcome, you know.
Right.
And when things like that transpire, and he can shoot up a movie theater and kill 12 people and harm many others, I mean, that's, you know, those are American-grown children that grow up to be teenagers and young men that have so much hatred for the humanity and America and the government that they choose this realm of things. And I think the media of gaming and different aspects like that. But it's not a blame game either. And we hear that after a disaster. And like with the National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation, which you and I are a part of, you know, our whole purpose is we have a dream, a world free of violence and exploitation. And someone tweeted me back when we posted that this week that unfortunately I don't think that's ever going to happen. And I would have to agree, but it doesn't hurt to dream about it. We do live in a very dangerous world, and we our efforts at NW Cave is to carry on the conversation, have the conversation, let people's voices be heard, and be able to learn from our past issues with all of, whether it's John Holmes, Columbine, Oklahoma, Boston.
There are a couple of cases going on now where the insanity plea is trying to be played out, and that's where they would just go to an institution, a lockdown institution, instead of going to prison, and that would be Holmes is trying to get an insanity plea, and Jodi Arias. Now, the insanity plea is called the M. Naughton rule. It's very hard to prove due to the fact that the offender or the perpetrator needs to prove that they did not know right from wrong. The Arias case is a little bit different because she's saying she was abused, so it's a little bit different, but Holmes... I don't know if he would be able to prove that he did not know right from wrong. So people that do try to go the way of the insanity plea, it's very difficult to prove, and it's not something that just comes easy. So, you know, that'll play out in court as well as Jodi Arias' case, but hers is a little bit different. She's saying that she killed due to domestic violence issues, so but she wasn't in her right mind. So it's very hard to prove the M. Naughton rule, but we'll have to see how all that plays out.
You know, the author of The American Terrorist, Dan Herbeck, that we heard earlier in the show, he made a point to say how McVeigh was articulate and intelligent and very likable. We heard those words quite a bit from a lot of friends that knew nothing about the Boston bombers. They were likable. You know, they are intelligent. You know, the college students that went to school with them stated that. You know, is there something to be said, and again, this would be a question for a psychiatrist, but do you find that a lot of these acts of violence do come, and we heard that in Jodi's case too, that she's very smart, has a very high IQ, and
right.
Yet we're finding that Americans with high IQs, articulate and intelligent and likable people, seem to do the most heinous crimes. Do you think there's anything to that?
Like I said, I'm not a psychologist or a psychologist, but from a criminological theory, these are the people that are high thinkers and think they can get away with something and also think that they are doing good by what they're doing. Their intelligence level is that, well, you know, America has done this wrong, so I'm going to show them, and here's how I'm going to show them. Obviously, they're not smart or intelligent because they've just injured or killed many, many people and have destroyed families. Jodi Arias claimed that she had an Einstein IQ. Her IQ is above average, but it's nowhere near Einstein's IQ. So, you know, the reasoning, maybe they think they can get away with it, then technology and criminal justice and crime scenes right now is just, there's so many ways to catch a perpetrator, and not all perpetrators are caught, but the technological advances in that system have jumped leaps and bounds and make it a little easier to catch who has done what. And we know video from this bombing case. We know video helped us, and that's technology. And
where technology hurts us, it also helps us.
Correct.
And the same goes for media. And again, that will be another show, but, you know, media definitely can help us, and it does matter. We believe media does matter. But in times, it could also backfire on us. But NWK believes in media, and we just want to give a plug. The application gets released next month for the Jane Velez Mitchell Journalism Award. So any journalists listening to this show, especially if you've been involved in the last week or any of your work that you have done in the past, consider applying or have someone apply for you for the Jane Velez Mitchell Journalism Award. The deadline will be September 30th, and you can get more information at nwcave.org or email us at info@nwcave.org. We also want to, again, give a shout-out to the folks that we've used their sound from this past week. Dr. Drew Pinsky, also the folks over at KOCO-TV, Channel 5, CNN, HLN, and we're going to be closing with Martina McBride with a Garth Brooks song. We thank them, and also Dr. Booker and Dr. Schaefer for being with us. If you're just tuning in to Voices for Justice, make sure to download the podcast and listen to the show from early on. The first half hour, we had Dr. Booker, Lonnie Booker, who is a professor of emergency management and terrorism at FSCJ. Very compelling. And Dr. Schaefer, please make sure we get him back because, like I said, I could talk to him forever.
Okay, well, thanks for having me.
Any last thoughts? Any?
The one thing that... that Dr. Drew said in his when he was talking about what do you tell your children, and you tell them that they're safe, and you tell them all that, I think you also have to tell them the truth. I don't know how you do that. I don't have children. I don't know how you do that sensitively, but I think, you know, everybody has to be aware that even children, that these things, these travesties, school shootings, bombings, terrorism, they all exist, and at any time it can happen again. But again, he's a psychiatrist, so he would probably know better than me, but my stand on it is to sensitively make everyone aware without panicking or going into panic mode and scaring everyone.
And there's a lot of ways you can do that, and I know that we'll have Dr. Archer back and Dr. Booker back at one point, but you know, we serve on the advisory council of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and throughout the month of May on Sundays here on Voices for Justice, we will be doing shows on Take 25. So learn about their campaign, TAKE25.org, because the campaign is great and they have a lot of ways that you can teach your children to stay safe, talk to them. But the biggest part to any of this, whether it's terrorism to trafficking to kidnappings to stranger danger, whatever the conversation, you have to have it. If you don't have the conversation, then the child is not going to be familiar or aware of their surroundings. And so start the conversation. As we say over at NCMEC, take 25 minutes, you know, if you can put a computer in the hand of a child, if you can, you know, show them television or let them watch movies or play games, you know, the first priority should be teaching them the safety of the you know, having the ability to play or watch those forms of media, because it really does matter. And that goes for the schools, too. If you're going to put a computer in the hand and teach a 3- or 4-year-old in preschool, which they did with my niece, teach them about the computer. First and foremost, teach them about the safety of using a computer. Because if you don't, you're just giving them a tool that may hurt them in the future. So at any rate, we appreciate you being on the show, Shelley, and we'll talk soon. And definitely thank Dr. Booker for coming on earlier with us. I know that he had other obligations, but tell him thank you so very much.
Okay, thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And we're going to close again. Reminder for anyone wanting to make a donation for the Boston bombings, the Attorney General Martha Coakley is asking everyone to go to onefundboston.org. And then the money will be dispersed through her office and other authorities. So not to be duped or tricked into giving money to a bogus nonprofit, onefundboston.org. Now we're going to end, you know, I can name off the victims that lost their life in Boston, or I can do the same with Oklahoma or Waco. There's just too many victims, and one victim is too many. So we're going to end tonight's show with Martina McBride singing Garth Brooks' song, The Dance. And it goes out to all the victims and their families and friends to say, you may be gone, but you're not forgotten. And we hope and pray that there won't be victims in the future. But unfortunately, in our society, that's not a promise we can keep. But from all of us here at NW Cave, be well, be safe, and step up to the plate. The power of community means a lot. Again, here's Martina McBride, and thank you.